We are talking today with Christian Williams. Christian Williams is a Portland-based writer and activist. His writings have appeared in Counterpunch, Columbia Journalism Review, In These Times, Extra, the publication of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and Alternet. He is the author of the book Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and he's here to talk about his new book, American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination. Christian, thank you for spending time with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
If you would begin, what was the motivation in putting together your new book, American Methods?
Partly it was a frustration with the U.S. media's treatment of the Abu Ghraib scandal. The general treatment in the American press was as though this was a total surprise and it came completely out of nowhere, whereas anyone who had been reading often the reporting in those same newspapers would have known that Bush had decided not to apply the Geneva Conventions in Afghanistan. They would have read reports about abuses in Bagram Airfield in Afghanistan, and they would have known a little bit about what was happening in Guantanamo Bay. Yet all of that context just got lost when the Abu Ghraib photos showed up, and all of the discussion was suddenly very focused on the particular abuses that were captured in the photographs. And then, you know, that's not even to mention the broader context of U.S. imperialism overall and the use of torture by police forces and prison guards within the United States. So really, frustration with the way that the Abu Ghraib scandal was being treated set me on this course of looking to provide some more background.
What did you find in terms of background and or history?
What I found really is that the Abu Ghraib scandal is more typical than exceptional. That very similar kinds of things have been reported elsewhere in Iraq, also in Afghanistan, also in Guantanamo Bay. And if we sort of look further back in the story, I mean, really, it would probably be possible to trace this history all the way back to the first colonization of North America. But I looked back about 25 years at the arc of American power since then and found the use of torture by the U.S. government and its allies really around the world whenever there's conflict that our government takes an interest in. And then in the second half of the book, I talk about the use of torture within the United States. And really the argument of the book is that torture isn't an add-on to imperial power. It's really characteristic of the power that our government has and the way it operates both domestically and around the world.
Maybe start back with where you began on in terms of history. I know that when I was working on issues dealing with Central America back in the late 80s, it was well known that torture was being used in those countries.
Yes, torture was commonly used in the 80s in all of the Latin American countries that had dirty wars. And the U.S. government's complicity in that took several different forms. Partly it took the form of funding. Throughout the 80s, the third largest recipient of U.S. military aid, right behind Israel and Egypt, was El Salvador. Interestingly, in the 90s, it was Turkey, who was involved with a counterinsurgency campaign against the Kurds. And then in the late 90s and the early aughts, it was Colombia, which is, of course, still involved in a major counterinsurgency campaign. So there's the funding. There's also training at places like the School of the Americas, and there's the provision of handbooks, the training manuals that are used at the School of the Americas, and also training manuals provided by the CIA. The manuals were largely based on, there was a deliberate effort on the part of the Defense Department to take the lessons of the Vietnam War and codify them and create a counterinsurgency model that could then be tested out in Latin America. And that was the origin of a lot of the training manuals, which then became the curriculum for the School of the Americas, which are still currently being used to train police and military in Latin America. The lessons that are relevant for the discussion on torture was largely involved the role of intelligence and the need to, on the one hand, sort of win hearts and minds, and on the other hand, ruthlessly purge any subversive elements from the population as a whole, not simply focusing on the particular militants, but looking for their base of support and trying to burn that out. And specifically in terms of the techniques that were used, there's been a consistent move over the course of the 20th century away from sort of simple physical brutality towards more subtle psychological ploys. So there's increased use of things like sensory deprivation, long-term isolation, induced psychosis, narcosis, and the manuals focus largely on mobilizing fear in the subject rather than relying simply on the pain.
Well, maybe we should back up and look at the definition of torture. How would you define it? And then it seems like that's something that, at least currently, that the administration of the U.S. government tries to change, you know, change the definition.
Right. My definition is deliberately rather broad. And it's basically the use of extreme pain or humiliation against a person who, at the moment, poses no physical threat. And you're right, the current administration has tried very hard to narrow the definition, really almost to the point of vanishing. They want to exclude as much as they can from the definition of torture so that they can continue to insist that they don't use torture while at the same time using techniques that, by their own admission, qualify as degrading, inhuman, or cruel. And this really sort of highlights a problem with the definitional arguments. It's that, you know, you can define it and then you can quibble endlessly about whether it's the right definition and whether the definition is aptly applied to the particular techniques that you're talking about. I think really it's more important to put the focus on the other end, and instead of thinking about what is torture, what isn't torture, instead to start with the question of, are these ways that it is right to treat people? And I'm sure that there are examples that I cite in my book that other people could honestly take issue with as to whether or not they actually qualify as torture. But I don't think any of those examples, there are very many people who are going to be willing to say that that is a way that people should be treated, whether or not it's torture. The question of humanity is more important than the definitional issue of what is or isn't torture.
You touched upon something that during the conflicts in Central America, that the policy was to weed out, if I'm reading you right, the policy was to use torture to weed out those people that were supporting a particular cause that the U.S. was opposed to?
Well, that's basic counterinsurgency theory, is that it's not enough to focus on the guerrillas, or it's not enough to focus on the insurgents, that you need to find their base of support in the population and neutralize that. And torture is a very useful tool in terrorizing whole populations of people. It's not that useful, by the way, for getting useful intelligence. Actionable intelligence is the current jargon. And it's been known for hundreds of years that it's not that useful for that. But it is very, very useful as a tool of terror. In Central America during the 80s, it was very effectively used for that end. So, you know, it wasn't simply suspected guerrillas who were disappeared. It was also school teachers, doctors, the members of relief organizations, members of the clergy, people who were either supporting or thought to be supporting the resistance movements.
So, in fact, it would seem that that use of terror, would be the most effective target group, would be these civilians that would be, you know, not the combatants, mm-hmm. but the civilians themselves.
I haven't seen numbers that compare the proportion of combatants who were abused relative to the proportion of civilians that were abused. But in either case, the civilian population was, in a way, the audience for the torture. They were the ones who were supposed to experience the terror more so than the combatants. So on the one hand, the military in the countries in question, such as El Salvador, would justify, you know, massacres of entire villages or the disappearance of, you know, journalists or whatever, in terms of fighting the insurgency, as though those people were either combatants or were giving some sort of support to the insurgency. But really the object of that kind of campaign is to terrorize the population in the hope that they will give up any support, either material or ideological, for the rebel groups.
One of the things one would read or hear about in the corporate media back during that time period was that the torture that was going on was something that originated from whichever country it was in. That's something that those people in those countries mm-hmm. do to each other. And over time, it sounds like there's been ample evidence that continues to come out showing that, in fact, the U.S. had a program like the School of the Americas where they were teaching these right. techniques.
I mean, largely, yeah. The person who was beating the prisoners or strapping electrodes to them would be an official of the government of the country in question. But they were doing it with American training, with American techniques, often with the money or equipment provided by the U.S., and really with the tacit or very nearly explicit approval of the U.S. government. And, for that matter, those campaigns were often supported by the U.S. under a calculation that it was in some way in our interests. So they were using our tools, our means, and serving our ends. The fact that the particular personnel who were involved happened to be Salvadoran or Honduran is really not that important.
Although there's even cases where I know that people who were being tortured later reported that they could hear in the room or, you know, knew of in the room of U.S. representatives right there.
Yes, the there have certainly been cases in which U.S. intelligence officers or special forces services were supervising the interrogations. And we know that of reports not only from the victims, but also from former torturers, members of, for example, the National Guard in El Salvador, who later sort of spilled the beans about what they knew and talked explicitly about the involvement of U.S. special forces in those sorts of interrogations. Something very similar is happening in Colombia now, by the way.
So how has the U.S. policies on torture changed since the 80s in, for instance, Central America?
Probably the biggest change is that it's more obvious now that the U.S. is involved in it. And part of that is that because of the military actions in Afghanistan and Iraq, and because of the present camp in Guantanamo Bay, American soldiers are more directly involved in the interrogations and more directly involved in the torture, both interrogational and otherwise. So during the 80s, there was a very deliberate effort to sort of maintain this plausible deniability. Since September 11th, the deniability has become increasingly less plausible. And in a way, it's sort of the margin has shifted so that it's not that soldiers in other countries do it and the U.S. pretends like it doesn't have a role. It's more like American soldiers do it and their superiors pretend like they don't have a role. And I think that change has been important in the way that American citizens think about these issues. And part of what was so shocking for the public about the Abu Ghraib scandal was that it wasn't Iraqis torturing Iraqis. It was very clearly American GIs torturing Iraqis.
What's interesting to me from that so far is that the people who have been prosecuted have all been lower level people within who had worked within the prison.
Yeah, I believe the highest ranking soldier who's been prosecuted is a staff sergeant, which is a non-commissioned officer and pretty low in the scheme of things. There's ample evidence to bring an indictment against Donald Rumsfeld, not only for Abu Ghraib, but he admitted before Congress that he had authorized that the CIA hide prisoners from the Red Cross. You know, he had instructed the Army to cooperate with CIA hiding prisoners from the Red Cross, which is a straightforward violation of the Geneva Conventions and also a violation of the U.S. War Crimes Act. So if there was the political will, his own admission provides evidence for an indictment. I don't expect to see that anytime soon.
So have the goals of why the U.S. is using torture changed since the 80s, where you pointed out earlier that You know, one of the key aspects is putting fear and terror in a given populace.
The targets have changed. There's much more emphasis on Arabs and Muslims now than there was in the 80s, when there was already, where they were already receiving more than their share of unwanted attention. But no, the purpose is basically the same, and the agenda that is being served is basically the same. What's changed since then? Two things. The Soviet Union went away, which removed the single largest counterbalancing force to American power globally. And then September 11th, 2001, the terrorist attacks really did a good job of muting dissent in the U.S. and temporarily muting criticism of the U.S. abroad, and thus provided more opportunity for the American government to exercise powers in a way that would have been more politically costly before. I mean, it's not really that they didn't want to have, you know, secret prisons in Eastern Europe before September 11th, but September 11th really gave them the opportunity to make that politically feasible.
So if getting information out of people is already known to not be affected by the use of torture, and torture is primarily aimed at the population of these countries that we're supposedly at war with, then their long-term goal here is to make it so that people aren't going to supposedly join these terrorist organizations?
That's a narrow piece of a broader picture. And the U.S. has been pretty out in the open about, the government has been pretty out in the open about its desire to maintain and, for that matter, expand global supremacy. Really, the object is to head off any potential resistance, any potential rival. And it's not just, you know, we'll torture people and then they won't join Al-Qaeda or Hamas. That's a narrow application of a much broader strategy, which is that if people are kept in enough fear that they won't pose any resistance to the U.S.'s agenda at all, anywhere. So it's not just a matter of this year we're after Al-Qaeda, but, you know, the people in Latin America certainly haven't forgotten what happened during the Dirty Wars. And I would imagine that people who are involved in resistance movements elsewhere probably look at, for example, the indefinite and really unappealable detention in Guantanamo Bay and can do the math to see that something similar could very easily happen to them if they are labeled as a threat. And for that matter, when I say around the world, I also mean within the U.S.
That would have been my next question, is that when you have an administration that says you're either with us or against us, and you have people that afterwards go marching in the streets, wouldn't they potentially be a target audience for these policies as well?
Not only a target audience, but potentially a target for the same sorts of abuse. Within the U.S., it's been, I'll actually give you an example from before the War on Terror. In the 90s, there was an effort in Northern California to prevent the logging of ancient redwoods. In Humboldt County, several people occupied, I believe it was a senator's office, in hopes to appeal to him to act to block the logging. They locked themselves together in a circle in a way that's probably familiar to a lot of your readers. And the sheriff's deputies, rather than, you know, patiently cutting through the chains and removing them, instead directly applied pepper spray fluid using Q-tips directly to the protesters' eyes. Now, ostensibly, the idea was that this should get them to release themselves and surrender for arrest. But it also sent a message to anybody else who was planning future actions, you know, that was how they were going to be dealt with, that they shouldn't expect civility or mercy. And I imagine that that message was received by the audience.
Talk about other ways that U.S. torture policy has changed over the last 25 years. You mentioned that they're using actual U.S. troops more now. Obviously, with Iraq, they're using more contractors for aspects of this. What other ways has it changed?
Well, there's been more of an effort to legitimize it. Previously, the line was, we don't use torture, we never have, we never will, which was wrong three times. Increasingly, the line is that we don't use torture, but we're willing to do everything short of it. And again, if you look at the extremely narrow definition, that's not a lot of comfort. But also, if you look at the details behind those proclamations, you'll see that what they mean is that they will reserve the right to use even what they consider torture in certain kinds of circumstances. So there's been a lot more effort to not just break the law and sneakily use torture, but also to insist that the law just doesn't apply, and to not just illicitly use torture, but also to justify that illicit use of torture, which makes for some weirdly incoherent statements coming out of the administration. Bush, for example, when John McCain was pushing for a bill that really would have only reasserted what the War Crimes Act already said, Bush insisted that the U.S. isn't using torture, but maintained that he had the right as commander-in-chief to authorize any interrogation techniques that might be necessary. If he doesn't intend to authorize torture, then why the fear of prohibiting it?
And does the U.S. have a preference for types of torture it tends to use? It appears with the Abu Ghraib photos that torture involving a sexual nature appears to be preferred.
I think it's more than a preference. I talk about this for an entire chapter in the book, that in every set of circumstances that I looked at, torture had commonly had a sexual component. And the argument that I make in the book is that sexual abuse isn't just a particularly useful type. It's actually the paradigm for torture overall. It's the model around which torture is organized. And we see this not just in what we saw very clearly in the Abu Ghraib photos, but it shows up also in Guantanamo Bay, where interrogators actively seek to sexually humiliate the prisoners in the theory that if they can drive a wedge of shame between the Muslim prisoners and God, then they can more effectively extract information from them. We also see it somewhat differently in prisons in the United States, where a major component of the way the prison society is organized is the use of rape to stratify the population, so that there are, you know, the dominant prisoners and there are the submissive prisoners. And that's not simply a matter of sort of bad people doing bad things to other bad people. It's an arrangement that the prison authorities themselves use as a way of controlling the inmate population.
Any ideas on both the use of torture and or the types of torture that the U.S. uses, what that says about the U.S. as a whole, about our society?
Well, it says some very troubling things. The prominence of rape and sexual abuse, I think those techniques show up in the torture chamber partly because they're familiar from the rest of society, that the torturers don't really need to be inventive or improvisational to mobilize sexual abuse for political ends, because in a society in which men dominate women, that's already sort of part of the political landscape. Those are ideas that they're familiar with, whether or not they have particularly experienced them before. So there's that. There's also the choice of victims, which overwhelmingly reflects the stratification of the society overall. So it tends to be both overseas and domestically, poor people and people of color who suffer torture. And I think that's just a straightforward reflection of the way our society is organized.
Any insights into the U.S. populist reaction to the Abu Ghraib scandal and the torture?
I talk about this a little bit in the book around the same time that I talk about the definitional issue. I looked at several surveys over a few years of how the public reacted to that and whether the public was willing to would say that they would accept the use of torture and the war on terror. And after the Abu Ghraib scandal, the number of people who said that they would accept the use of torture and the war on terror dropped, I think partly because people started thinking in more concrete terms of what that would mean. It stopped being such an abstract issue. A little bit more puzzlingly, the majority of Americans are not willing to, if you talk to them about specific techniques, they're not willing to approve of something like waterboarding or using dogs to intimidate prisoners or keeping people naked in long-term solitary confinement or that sort of thing. But the numbers of people who disapprove of the particular techniques are much higher than the numbers of people who will say that they are not willing to consider torture at all. And I think this, again, relies on sort of some definitional confusion, where the idea of torture is vague and undefined enough that in the abstract, people are willing to consider it, even if in the concrete, when you talk about specific techniques, they're not. In a way, I think this is kind of a hopeful sign, in that it shows that the effort to simply define down torture is not really going to bring the legitimacy to those sorts of techniques that the Bush administration may hope for. That whether or not you call it torture, most Americans are against using dogs against unarmed prisoners. And I don't know, that can only be for the best.
So what are you hoping to accomplish with your book?
At the time of the Abu Ghraib scandal, it wasn't just the media that presented it sort of in isolation. Most of the population seemed to think that it was anomalous, that it was sort of a fluke. And part of what I want to show is the systematic nature of torture and the way that torture is a very predictable consequence from the way power is organized in our society. So to make that case, I needed to show that it wasn't exceptional, that it was systematic, and that the same sorts of things occur not just elsewhere in Iraq, but wherever the American military is involved, and also domestically at the hands of police and prison guards. So part of the aim was to bring a broader context to the discussion. Connected to that was the idea that it's not enough simply to find the people who are doing the abuse and stop them or punish them. That really, if we want to get rid of torture altogether, we need more fundamental changes in our society.
And what changes would you like to see?
Well, moving from sort of modest to radical, at the very least, we need to recommit ourselves to, for example, the standards of the Geneva Convention and the Conventions Against Torture and the domestic laws that basically enact the same sort of standards. So we need to fight against the erosion of the international regime of human rights. But that's not really going to be enough. So sort of one level up, we also need to work for really radical changes within the institutions that are responsible for this, that being the military, the prison system, the police. And then at the broadest level, if we're really serious about stopping torture, we need to get rid of the systems of power that use it and that make it necessary. So presently, torture is used to maintain inequalities based on race and class. If we want to eliminate that as a means, we need to change the ends that they serve. So we need to push for more equality at every level of our society.
Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
We've just been talking with Christian Williams, who is a Portland-based writer and activist and author of the new book, American Methods: Torture and the Logic of Domination.